Hey everybody, Nate here. Before the show, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about our sponsor, the Snack Nanny. The Snack Nanny is the latest, greatest spill-proof bowl. It's the first snack bowl for kids with a self-closing door. The Snack Nanny allows kids to snack freely without overeating, keeps kids entertained, and prevents them from creating a mess for mom and dad to clean up. Kids and parents love the Snack Nanny. It's easy to use, easy to clean, and includes portion control features that only the Snack Nanny offers. To order, go to www.snacknanny.com. or order from Amazon. Remember, you support our sponsors and they support us. Thanks and Nihei Debiru. Hey everybody, welcome back to Chop Talk. This is your host, Nate England. Today's show is part two of my interview with Travis Voles, and this interview is from the archives, so the audio quality is a little bit rough. Hope you guys can bear with that. In today's show, Travis turns the tables on me and actually does the interviewing himself. So he asked me how I got started in the martial arts and what took me to Okinawa. Hope you guys enjoy the show. Thanks for listening.
Something interesting else to say. This is the part where I edit out.
What got you involved in martial arts?
Me, and pretty much the same thing that gets most people involved. You know, they want to meet Asian women.
But you know, you get in there, and it turns out that there aren't that many. You know, it's mostly just middle-aged white guys with lots of facial hair. And then you're like, oh, all right, I guess I'll stick around.
So I guess that explains the trip to Oakland Island.
Yeah, you got to go to the source. But then you get over there, and it's still it's still a bunch of middle-aged men. Yeah, you know. But no, it's just something that was really interesting to me for a long time, I started getting interested in it and wanted to check this out, and then went to the library and sort of checked out every book on the subject and read through those, and then tried to talk to my dad. It's like, hey, you know, I think I want to do karate. He's like, no, you don't. Every time I talked to him, he just kind of blew me off.
So what are his opinions on it now that you've went to Okinawa and you've...
Well, here's the thing. Well,
been studying
after a while of me asking him, hey, I want to do this, he's kind of like, well, you know, when I was in high school, I studied karate too. I'm like, oh, really? I mean, tell me this a year ago, or when I started talking about this, or 10 years ago, or something. But it's the kind of guy he is. He just doesn't.
Approximately what age were you when the interest got sparked?
I was probably junior high school, so probably about. Yeah, probably about 8th grade, 7th or 8th grade.
Okay, so a year approximately around then?
Yeah. So I started when I was 15, so I just started my sophomore year of high school. So I started in October of 95.
Okay.
I was a sophomore in high school then. So it turned out, my dad, when he was in high school, he'd studied with Mr. Keppel School as well. In Peoria.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he made it to. I guess he made it to green belt. He said they had a review one night, and so they had a sparring match, and everyone had to go out and spar. Then he had to spar, but when he sparred, he had to spar two guys, and then he wound up doing really well, like beating them. And so then when they did the promotions, they called everybody out, and everyone got like one promotion, like yellow belt, and this guy promoted to blue belt, and this guy promoted to blue belt, and so he called everybody out but him. He's like, oh crap, what did I do wrong? And so they called him out and gave him like a double promotion. So he basically went from like yellow to green.
Okay.
In the same night. So that was sort of that's how he got started. Then he didn't stick with it very long. And then his brother was in it at the same time. So but they didn't stick with it very long at all. But yeah, for me, I mean, as soon as I got, but basically when I went there, they gave me sort of introductory lesson, and they showed me around the dojo, and basically I looked up. I remember exactly when it was too. They were walking me around. They're showing me all the different. They had all these pictures on the wall. These historical photos of like some of the old Okinawan guys and everything. And I'm like, looked at that. I'm like, all right, I'm gonna be a black belt. And at that time, I had no idea what that meant. You know, yeah. I didn't know how long you had to work out. I didn't know what you had to do. I didn't know anything. But I'm like, all right, yeah, okay, I want to be a black belt. And so. Sort of. Also, I realized, you know what? I'm gonna do this the rest of my life, and I just sort of knew that from the beginning, from that first day, and then from then on, I just fell in love with it, and I just did it, just constantly. I was at the dojo.
Just felt like you fell right into place.
Yeah, I was at the dojo like almost every day, and yeah. I was doing everything. You know, there was I mean, it's a definitely different dynamic than the dojo here in Cincinnati. You know, there's a lot more people, there's kids and stuff like that. But there's a lot of other classes offered too, you know. So there's karate, of course, but then there was judo once a week, and then there was a Japanese sword class once a week, and like a Okinawan weapons class. And so I just started everything. I started doing everything. And so I was going to class. I was there, you know, pretty much six days a week, you know, 5 or 6 days a week, right from the beginning. Just kept going.
Way longer journey than you thought, the black belt, huh?
It took me...
Time probably went quick, though.
It did, you know. I got my... Let's see, it took me a little over 4.5 years, probably about 4 years and 9 months to get black belt. There was another guy in the school who got his black belt in the review before mine. And maybe two reviews before mine. But he wound up setting sort of the dojo record. He made brown belt in less than a year, and then he was the fastest person to ever make it to black belt. It was like, it was under, you know, 4 years and 6 months. But the thing is, that guy was working out something like, his name's Kevin Scoin, by the way, and he was working out, you know, upwards of, you know, 350, 400 hours a year. So on his time card, you know, he's going to classes, you know, 3 and 4 classes a night, every night, and he's just always there. So where a lot of people might go, you know, 2 or 3 times a week and kind of stretch that out, I mean, he just crammed it in. It was real impressive. It's real impressive.
What made you want to adventure to Okinawa?
You know, for me, it was... It was just sort of something I felt that I needed to do. It was a combination of things. I wanted to live outside the U.S. I was just interested in doing that. And then obviously I had a real big interest in martial arts and sort of Japanese and Okinawan history. And I just felt like if I was going to be serious about training in the martial arts, I needed to go to where karate started.
Approximately how old were you when you went?
I was 27. So I went, the first time I went, I mean, I'd never been out of the country until I was in grad school. One time I was. When I was in junior high, my grandparents had a camper. And so we went out to Yellowstone, and we went out to Maine, went out to all these different places during the summers, you know. And, one time we were up at Niagara Falls, and so we're bugging my grandpa. Oh, we want to go. We want to the Canadian side. We want to go to the Canadian side. So I was like, all right, fine. You know, get in the truck. So we got in the truck, and we cross over the bridge and go into Canada, right? And but my grandpa, something happened. One of the drivers did something, or he couldn't. Goddamn Canadian drivers! And he decided he wanted to get the hell out. Just immediately after the checkpoint. And so he's driving around, and then all the streets were one way, you know, kind of like downtown, you know, so it's one way. And so we got all turned around. God damn it, we're going back to America. So We're like, no, Grandpa, Grandpa, wait, wait, we wanna get out and go. You're not getting out anywhere. We're going back. And so we convinced him to kind of pull over to the side of the road and let us open the door. So I opened the door and reached down and like touched the curb. And so I was in Canada briefly and then went back. But I don't think I ever actually stood in Canada, but I touched the curb with my hand. But that was it. I was in grad school at Miami, and there was a guy, Stan Russell, was teaching a Japanese architectural history course. And he had lived in Japan for something like 13 or 14 years. He married a Japanese woman. And when he was there, he was studying traditional Japanese carpentry. So he was learning about, how to do the woodworking, everything. And he's training as an apprentice to do all this stuff and all these, like, intricate joinery, you know, because in traditional Japanese architecture, they don't use nails or anything like that. They cut both pieces of wood. To fit together. I got the other piece up here. So, yeah, there's a piece. And so they actually cut both ends of the wood to fit together, and then they, you know, put it together at pegs and everything like that, and all the finish. And so
pretty solid too.
Yeah, it is. It is. I made that one. Oh, but yeah, there was one of his things in his class was we had to would make make a joint. And so he was over there, and so he organized this Japan summer studio. So he was going to take a group of about a dozen students over to Japan. Stay in Kyoto for like 6 weeks and go around and travel and see this other stuff. And so I was really interested in this. And so I, decided I'm going to sign up for this thing. And then the same day that I signed up, I got a call from my teacher, Joseph Walker. And he goes, "Mr. England." I'm like, "Yes, sir." He's like, "How would you like to go to Okinawa?" And I'm like, "I'd love to. And by the way, I'm already going to Japan this summer anyway, so I can just sort of stop by." So, okay, that works out. So he was taking a small group of guys over to Okinawa to train. There's a big seminar put on by Morio Higa Ona, who's a real famous Goju-ryu guy. And every 4 years he puts on this big seminar, the World Budosai. And so he has this big tournament, and Goju people from all over come in. But other people are invited too. And so we went over... So I went over with the school group, and then I took a week off and went down to Okinawa. Worked out there. And I also had decided to make my graduate thesis project on Okinawan architecture also. So I had all these multiple reasons that kind of just came together at the right time. And so I went down there for a week, and I got to train and work out with, and see Okinawa for the first time. So you're seeing all these things that you read about. So you go up there and seeing Shuri Castle, and you're walking around and seeing there's all these like little monuments, or they have little plaques talking about all the different karate guys, and just all this stuff that you've heard about. You've either heard stories about, or you've read about, and it's all right there. It's really cool. It's sort of, and Okinawa is the place where, whatever style of karate you're in, it's the place that everyone wants to go. It's literally mecca for karate guys. Like, at some point in their life, that you have to go there. There I was, and it was awesome. But so I was there for about 8 days, 9 days, something like that. And then I went back, joined the rest of the school group up in Kyoto. And at the end of that trip, I decided that Japan was really cool, but I will never ever live there. I'm done. It was because it's hard, being in a different country. And after 6 weeks, I was just burnt out.
You went back after that, though, didn't you?
I did. And but so then after, the next year, I was still in school, and I started thinking about it a little bit more, and I was talking to my good buddy, Jabari Garland, who's working in New York now, and we were real good friends, and we talked about it, and we're like, "Hey, man, when we graduate, the job market's not looking that good. know, just go over to Japan and see what happens. And he's like, yeah, that's awesome. I'm like, all right, let's do it. And so
you went there just shooting off the hip.
Yeah, well, pretty much. Well, you know, school ended, and then we kind of both realized it, and he was sort of not in a good financial position to do it at that time. I could have gotten by, and that's really what I would have done, gotten by. But I had other personal stuff that I had to get done as well. So we kind of looked at it, and we're like, all right, well, let's do it in 2 years. So 2 years from now, we're going to, you know, get some money in the bank, get everything taken care of, and then we'll go. But 2 years went by, about a year and a half went by. I picked up the phone. I was like, hey, man, you ready to take off? And he's like, I don't think my girlfriend would be too happy about that. And so I think I'm just going to go ahead and stay here. And I'm like,
You already said at that point.
Yeah, I'm like, all right, I'm still going. He's like, all right, good luck. I'm like, cool. And I went.
Nice journey by yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And I went, and that's how I wound up back over there. So it was quite an experience.
What'd you do for income, lodging, just eating and everything in general while you were there?
Well, in those 2 years, I was basically anything I earned, I put in the bank. Like, I had a pretty Spartan lifestyle. I mean, I'm still driving the same car now that I was then.
I
just sort of had it in my mind that I needed to build up my bank account as much as possible because I was going to do this, and there's a good chance that I wasn't going to have much income for a while if I did. And, you know, so I was working, you know, extra jobs and, you know, did a couple things freelance, and I was taught a drafting course at the local college, and basically that was traveling money. That would just went right in the bank, and that's what it was for, and it would, you know, wasn't going towards anything else. So I had a decent amount saved up when I went. And so that's what I lived on for the first chunks. I went over there for 6 months was the first one. Okay. And so in Japan, you can get a 90-day, when you go over there, you get a 90-day tourist visa, okay? And so you can stay in the country for 90 days. Well, I did that, and then you have to do something. You can't just stay in the country because then you're there illegally and you're going to get arrested or kicked out or something. So basically, I hopped out of the country. I went down to Taiwan for a week or two and then came back and reset my visa, so I had another 90 days. And at the end of that, there was a little mix-up with my plane ticket. My supposedly open-ended plane ticket was not as open-ended as it was when they sold it to me. And so I faced I was sort of in the position where either I went back to the U.S. And used that ticket, or I lost it. And I was stuck. And I was going to have to leave the country anyway, because my 90 days was coming to an end. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll go back to the U.S. for a little while, sort of reset, and then come back to Asia. So I'm back to the U.S., and I was back in my hometown. We went to one of the local bars downtown that I like. This is an Irish pub down on the waterfront. And I was there, and I had been looking at plane tickets back to Asia that earlier that day, and in fact I was ready. There's a like this great deal to a ticket to Thailand, and I was gonna take us like $600 for this ticket to Thailand. Well, that looks pretty good, so I was gonna take it, and I was out with one of my buddies at this just having a drink, catching up, and so one of the guys I worked with at the architecture company there. And so I started talking, like, hey, you know, what are you guys up to now? He's just talking to me about this and that. He's like, told me they had this really big project out in California, and they were sending a bunch of guys out there to work, and they're going to be doing all this overtime, and, you know, this great chance to, you know, make a whole bunch of money. And I'm like, oh, wow, sounds great. You know, if I wasn't going back to Asia next week, I'd be up for that. He goes, really? And I'm like, yeah, really. He's like, all right, you wait here. So he leaves the bar, runs down a couple blocks to where the office was, goes up, calls his supervisor, comes back down the bar, and I'm like, where you been, man? He's like, well, if you want a job, you got one. And I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. I'm like, all right. So I went to California for 6 months. And basically, I had a chance to make what I would normally make in a year in about 6 months. And so I did that. That all went back into the bank. And then at the end of that 6 months, I went back to Okinawa. And that's when I sort of had that's when I stayed for the extended period. That's when I was there for like 2 years. After, you know, that money started running low, and I was trying to get a job doing architecture, but that wasn't going to work out. I had one guy offer to sort of falsify my visa if I agreed to work for him for 9 months, 6 days a week, from 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. for no pay. No. And so then I started doing what everybody has to do when you're over in Japan. The only job us foreigners can get is teaching English. So I started teaching a few people sort of freelance, just people wanted to do conversation. So they gave me like $20 and I sat there and talked to them for an hour and helped them with their grammar or helped them with pronunciation and stuff like that. And then found a local conversation school at home, Eikaiwa's, English conversation schools, and offered me a job, and that's how I got my visa. So I got my working visa, and that's what I was doing. So I taught English for them, and then wound up teaching for a high school as well.
So who introduced you to the people that you trained with in Okinawa?
Nobody.
Or did you just go
there and find him? It's sort of a mixture. With Shinzato Sensei, who I started with, you know, when I went over for the Budo side, that big tournament, Higa Ona brought in a few people from outside of Goju. And so they would teach like individual seminars. So they had the Goju guys doing the main thing. And that's what they were doing every day. But then he brought in guys to teach one seminar here or there, doing Shorinru people and different Ruiru guy. And they had some other guy doing Kabuto. And they had all these different things. And so one of the seminars was taught by Shinzato, Katsuhiko Shinzato. And he was a really interesting guy. The seminar was really, it was just really interesting and really compelling. And I remember him talking about blocks, you know, and how different blocks worked. And so he was demonstrating. And so a lot of people, when they have a demonstration, it's pretty choreographed. They have one of their guys come out, they throw a punch, they do a block, and you follow up with some other move. But he just sort of picked a random guy out of this group. He's like, come on up here. And he's like, okay, well, go ahead and punch. Throw a technique. And the guy punched him, and Shizato, blocked it. And he's like, okay, try something else. And he blocked it. He's like, all right, try something else. And he blocked it. And, he's trying to block in this. And then the guy, he's from New Zealand, starts getting pissed off. He's this fucking old man. He's, blocking all this. And so he starts to really try to hit him. And so he's throwing all these techniques and throwing all these punches and getting this red face. And Shinzato Sensei is just kind of real casually sort of, blocking it. He's explaining different things as he's going through. The guy's just blocking it. And this guy was really trying to hit him. And he couldn't. And so I was just completely relaxed and explaining things as he went along. That was really, really interesting. And I remember right before I went to another seminar here in the U.S., and the guy was talking about how traditional blocks don't work. Traditional, there's nothing, they're garbage. They don't work. And so I had been thinking up to that point, is it that the blocks don't work, or is it that maybe we're not doing the blocks right, or what is it about this that's, because people were doing these blocks for some reason, they didn't do them for hundreds of years just because they, they felt like it because it looked cool. I mean, there's some reason they were doing them. And here was Shinzato Sensei doing all these traditional blocks, and they were working. And that was really interesting to me. And So I went up and I talked to him afterwards, and his English was really good. He was used to be the head of the foreign languages department at one of the major universities in Okinawa. So his English was really good. And so he was friendly and, you know, talked to me a little bit and gave me his card. And so, yeah, keep in touch. And so I exchanged literally two emails with him over the course of the next 3 years, something like that. You know, because like I said, I still had another year of grad school. I sent him one email asking something about Okinawan stuff because I was writing a paper on Okinawa, and then another email here, another email there, but nothing really major. And then when I got back, when I was going down to Okinawa, I sent him emails and, hey, you know, I'm going to be in Okinawa. Would it be okay if I stopped by and watched a class? And he said, yeah, sure. So I met up with him. He kind of took me out to dinner and talked to me for a little while and took me back to his dojo, which is in his house. Most of the ones in Okinawa are.
How far were you in your karate career at this point in time?
I was a black belt.
Okay.
So I made black belt in 2000. And then I had made my third degree black belt in 2007. So I made it in March 2007, and I left for Japan in June. So I made my third degree black belt a few years before that. So I had quite a bit of experience, but not a whole lot outside of my school. You know, I've been to a couple of seminars. You know, I've been to Ridgely Abel Seminar down in North Carolina, Mr. Bull's Seminar in Fort Wayne, and then, you know, I had taught at, I had started the karate club at University of Illinois, and then also at Miami University when I was there. So, you know, I'd been around a little bit, but I didn't have a ton of outside experience. And so he's, you know, come on back, you want to work out too? I'm like, yeah, sure. So I jumped in and worked out with him, and they decided they liked me, and I just kept going back there. And then he was the one who introduced me. He was great because he introduced me to a whole bunch of other people too. So we got to, he took me to Shimabukuro's dojo, and Shimabukuro's father was friends with Grandmaster Trias, and they'd worked out together. And then I worked out at Higa Ono's dojo as well when I was there, he introduced me to the people at Miyahiro's dojo, who then I started working out there regularly as well. And so those guys are, you know, Miyahiro's, like, 91 or 92 at this point, and he wasn't doing so well, but you know, he had worked out with all the guys you read about in the history books. So, like, he was, you know, probably one of the last living people that worked out with, you know, Choki Motobu, and his main teacher was Chosen Shibana. So these are all guys that you read one of these books, and these are the guys that they're talking about, and he was the one working out with them. And so these guys were probably about as close as you could get to what karate looked like 100 years ago than anybody. I say that because, you know, it changes. It evolved. I mean, karate's not exactly, no matter what anyone says, it's not exactly the same today as it was in, you know, 1750.
Evolved naturally like everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. It changes, whether it's, you know, whether it's intentional or whether it's by accident or whether it's by, you know, necessity. It just gets tweaked, gets modified. But these guys, you know, with Miyahiro's, I mean, still being alive, being in his 90s, and his students still pretty much continuing what he did. These guys, in my opinion, are as closest to what karate looked like 100 years ago as you're going to find.
How much difference did you see in it?
They look like they're definitely cousins to what we're doing, you know? Like, they have, you know, you talk about the Taikyoku katas, they have katas that are very similar to that. So, Kihon kata, or basic kata, that's a different name, but it's clearly the same kata. You know, then the Nihonshi is similar. They have a Basai that's similar. They have actually three different Basais that they ran. They had a Matsumura Basai, named after Bushi Matsumura. And they had an Itusno Basai, named after Anko Itus. And these guys are in our lineage. But you can tell, because those guys are one generation apart. Itus learned from Matsumura, and here they are. Here's the two katas. You can see where the guy changed them a little bit. Okay, maybe this block is of the closed hand. Maybe this is this. Maybe this is that. But they're still working those. And, you know, I'm not saying that necessarily not changing it is a good thing or changing it is a bad thing. I'm just sort of, this is sort of the way it was. So I was able to work out with these guys and sort of see like a little time capsule of, you know, what it sort of looked like and where everything came from. And so you could, and it was interesting to see that, how things evolved. So how, you know, how maybe what we're doing now in a certain kata, where it came from, or maybe it's because it was interpreted slightly differently and this guy started working this one interpretation, or maybe, you know, someone decided to tweak something or change something at a different angle. And so that was really interesting as well. And then Shinzato was sort of completely different.
All right, everybody, that does it for episode 2. I'd like to thank Travis again for sitting down with me, and also thank Tito Hobbles for providing the bumper music. In next week's episode, I share a couple stories about working out with Shinzato Sensei and training in Jodo, not Judo. And I share a few other stories about working out and living in Okinawa. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week. Nihei de biru, and mata ya.